beginning in the 1800s, thousands of Native American and Alaska Native children were sent away each year to federal or privately run boarding schools. On top of being separated from their families and culture, the conditions and abuse children experienced at some of these schools created a generation of loss that continues today. We're discussing the legacy of boarding schools and how it forces us to re-examine Alaska Native education today on Talk of Alaska.
Funding for Talk of Alaska was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Prescription opioids can be addictive and dangerous, especially when not used as prescribed. If you or someone you know is struggling with prescription opioids, there is hope. Recovery is possible. To hear real stories of recovery or for resources to begin the journey to healing, visit opioids.alaska.gov or contact your local health provider. This message sponsored by Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
Alaska USA has been on a journey with Alaskans since their first member account was opened in 1948. They'll be with you every step of the way, through the challenges of today and the hopes of tomorrow. AlaskaUSA.org. This message sponsored by Alaska USA.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Many communities in Alaska have held vigils or created memorials this past month following the discovery of the remains of 215 Indigenous children on the grounds of a residential school in Canada. Global remembrances have been held for those who died while attending boarding schools and for those who survived and live with the impacts of forced assimilation. Many of those survivors are speaking out today, sometimes after decades of silence. They are also working to bring more visibility to this history and healing to the families harmed by it. Here to discuss that with us today are Fred John Jr., who attended the Wrangell Institute in Southeast Alaska and several other boarding schools in the Lower 48. Also on the line is Jim LaBelle, who attended Wrangell and Mount Edgecombe and serves on the National Native American Board. Serves on the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. And in the studio with me today is Paul Unktaguk, who recently retired as the Director of Alaska Native Studies for the University of Alaska Anchorage. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Fred and Jim, thanks so much for being with us, too. And you can join us. Alaskans, did boarding schools play a role in your family history? Have you found healing, whether by talking about what happened or some other way? What do you think it will take to truly address this legacy? If you'd like to join our program, you can give us a call. Across the state, the number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8433. 550-8433. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, and we do have a few emails in that we'll get to in just a moment. Before we get started, I want to note that today's program deals with incidents of abuse and neglect that may be difficult for some listeners to hear. This topic is especially triggering, or can be, for Alaska Native people who have dealt with the effects of colonization for generations. The National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition has a list of resources, and we've linked to that on our website. So if you feel a need to reach out, you can go to the Talk of Alaska post on alaskapublic.org and find those links to get some help. Paul, how about if you start us off by giving us sort of an overview of the policy that led to this creation of Indian boarding schools?
Oh, thank you for inviting me on this. In brief, the federal government had been trying to eliminate the property rights of tribes and remove us from our traditional lands when there was resistance, particularly military resistance by the tribes. It was expensive and it was difficult. People don't understand that tribes were actually formidable opponents to the government, the colonists, and later the U.S. government in the early era. One of the strategies that was developed was to end the Indian Wars by ending Indianness. And one of the venues for doing that was missionaries, converting people not only to Christianity, but away from being Indian. That was not completely successful. And at one point, Captain Pratt, who was with the United States Army, had taken over control of Indian prisoners of war and had been trying to actively convert them to Christianity and to de-Indian them. And he was considered successful enough that the U.S. Army gave him facilities to open a federally operated boarding school on a U.S. Army base in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And that's the origination of the federal policy of using boarding schools as a way of pulling the next generation away from the tribes and trying to eliminate what they consider to be the savageness, the Native American cultures that they were a part of and their languages, and force those young children into becoming good laborers for the white population in the United States. There really wasn't even a promise of citizenship. The goal was to develop good laborers for the white population of the U.S.
So it was sort of the old idea of divide and conquer, as far as if you are dividing communities and taking the young people out of those communities, it's much harder for them to form coalitions for resistance.
Right. The goal is to win sort of the hearts and minds of the next generation so that they would look down upon their own traditional cultures and would aspire to become entry-level people into the white population's social structure, not as equals, but as good laborers for that population. And you essentially wipe out the cultures. And that was considered to be much more efficient, less expensive than the Indian Wars that were occurring at the time.
Would you say that generally, especially initially, that a lot of those schools with that backdrop, that philosophical backdrop, were they more along the lines of forced labor camps than they were actual schools? I've heard stories of young people having to work long hours in big plots of land raising vegetables that the schools would sell. And so I wondered about how much work was involved versus actual education.
Well, in Captain Pratt's mind and in the mind of the federal government, the stereotype was that Indians were just lazy people, which is impossible to imagine if you really understand what it takes to do a cycle of traditional life. I mean, it's exhausting and it's very demanding. But that wasn't the image. The image was that, you know, you hunt and you pick berries and life is good, sort of this Garden of Eden view. And given that, the government policy was to train Indian students into day laborers, manual labor. And that was considered to be a part of the civilizing process of Native American children. So that was a part of it. And also it was a way to lower the cost of operating the boarding schools for the federal government, which was always important. In the summertime, the children were typically not allowed to return home. So this is a year-round experience for whatever time they're there. And in the summertime, they were essentially loaned out or sold, leased to members of the white community to serve as laborers, servants, maids, whatever manual labor that was available for them. So there was a very high attrition rate There was a very high number of students who were dying from probably the geographic shift, probably from the population shift.
From loneliness?
From loneliness, from abuse, from malnutrition. There were just multiple reasons, from accidents, given the kind of labor that they were involved in, which were all pre-OSHA. Mm. So we really don't understand how awful it must have been for the families, for the children, and for the tribes to have been subject to this kind of policy by the federal government.
I read one account in the ICER study that Diane Hirschberg, Professor Hirschberg, helped lead about the boarding school era, of one participant in the study who had not been allowed to go home for 9 years, had not seen their family for 9 years, and didn't recognize their parents, had left at five, didn't recognize their parents or the community, could not reconnect to the community. Jim LaBelle, let's get you in here now, and then we'll turn to Fred as well. Tell us about your experience at boarding schools.
Well, it certainly begins with being taken to the airport, and our mom in Fairbanks left my younger brother and I there at the hands of the BIA officials. And the first thing that they did was they tied us together with other children with ropes at the Fairbanks airport. And there was dozens of other children that are already tied there. I remember this so well, even though it happened 67 years ago. I can still recall some of the younger children, as young as five, were there. I was eight. My brother was six. And we were thrust into just an alien situation where there was a lot of barking of orders, and we were given name tags, yellow name tags affixed to our clothing that had our names, our destination, flights, that kind of thing. And then it took almost a half a day, sometimes longer, to get to Wrangell. Number of stops. We were met at the town of Wrangell with there was buses there that took us out to about 5 miles outside of the community, where we were separated. The boys and girls were separated, and in the boys' dorm, the first things they had us do was to strip completely naked on this receiving room, concrete floor. A lot of children did not understand the commands, the directions, and oftentimes in frustration, a lot of matrons would run over to these little guys and just kind of rip their clothing off. That was a good hint that the rest of us better get undressed. The first thing we did was line up. We were all told to get in a line as to get our haircuts, and these were done in a way that was kind of like being sheared. If you ever see these videos of sheep being sheared off, well, that's what happened to us little guys. That was toward the end of the line, and I remember, as I got closer to that line, the mound of hair was growing around this barber's stand. And and of course, again, it just heightened the trauma that children had. as they went through the line. We were later led into an open shower stall where we were all forced to bathe. They gave us Lysol and washcloths and that kind of thing. And again, little children who never, who probably never really bathed themselves, were, they did not understand the commands. They only spoke their language. And again, the frustration level rose with some of these matrons so that, and I still remember in frustration this one matron took a bar of Lysol and he rubbed it against a floor brush and proceeded to vigorously brush this little kid until he bled. And again, that was another signal to the rest of us that we had better clean ourselves in the shower room or get that same fate. Along the line, we were given clothing, and government-issued clothing with our numbers on that, on our clothing, on our bedding. It even became part of our mail. Children who had difficult names were often referred to only by their number by many matrons. And I can still remember years later, children, as we were much older, talking about, gee, I thought my name was my number. I had six different sets of numbers, so I have them here. It's very, very painful to look at, so I try not to see my numbers. Mm. I probably will one day. And then that was the first day, lights out. That evening, children started crying. They were sobbing for their mothers mostly, and it caught on one child to the next, and pretty soon the entire dorm was kind of wailing into the night. I remember waking up. We all had practically swollen eyes were shut. There was no one that came to console us or hold us or tell us where everything's going to be okay. And, of course, that did not happen for at all. And there were some that tried, but I can still remember they themselves ran off in frustration because they couldn't comfort all of us.
That was the first day. I can't imagine. It sounds like a prisoner of war concentration camp, not a school. And just the trauma of that first day is profound. And then to have that experience for years on end is difficult to even begin to comprehend. Jim, thank you for sharing that with us. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the legacy of Native boarding schools. On the line with us are Fred John Jr., who attended the Wrangell Institute, calls himself a Wrangell Institute survivor, and several other boarding schools in the Lower 48. Jim LaBelle also attended Wrangell and Mount Edgecombe and serves on the National Native American Board Boarding School Healing Coalition, and Paul Unktaguk, who is recently retired as the Director of Alaska Native Studies for the University of Alaska Anchorage. You can join our conversation if you have questions or comments. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 550-8433. 550-8433. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. And we do have resources on the Talk of Alaska post on our website at alaskapublic.org. If you are feeling distressed about the conversation today, there are resources available there. So please do reach out if you need help in hearing about these experiences. Fred, you're on the line with us from Fairbanks. As Jim relayed in an earlier interview, you also spoke of having your hair shaved off when you first got to school. What are you comfortable discussing about your experience attending the schools that you went to?
Okay, I'll just continue from what Jim said. That what he said was I went through the same thing, and I was there from 1950 to 57. I was the first 2 years I didn't go home. My younger sister was 5 when I was 7 when we went, and I had 2 older brother went with us. We were there almost 7 years. Continuing, it was like a military thing. We lived during the day by the whistle, and my number was 77. And before the first 2 years ended, I almost forgot my name. Until my brothers keep telling me, your name is Fred, don't forget that. And it was 77, do this, 77, come up to the office, 77, report to this, report to there. The other one is the punishment we get. There's people there that were given that we do the smallest thing, and we get punished for it. Like our clothes, our coat be on the floor, or we're late, or but the spanking is on Saturday night. I mean on Saturday morning, the big kids would line up for spanking, and their pants would be around their knees in the barbershop, and I think 12 swats, I don't know. I don't remember now, but it was lots. The big kids were all 10, and they would, a lot of them wouldn't cry. They make sure they would not cry. But us little one, we get the same amount of spanking, and we had all line up beside them. The big ones would get spanking first, and then that's a little one. But us, we'd be crying before when we get... The big guys get their spanking gun. We watch them. And then when it was our turn, the only good thing about that is the big boys could take our place if they want to. And a lot of them did. They did their second spanking. They take spanking for us too. My brothers would take 2 spanking on Saturdays for me. Another one is the gauntlet. That strip us down if we turn really really bad, but if we're bad boys, and they have two lines up and down beside the bed, and it'd be those guys at Tattletale be standing on a bed and watch all the whole thing, and the boy it would strip them down naked and run down through the gauntlet. Boys on both sides would pull their belt out and would hit them with the heart in, you know, the buckle in as he ran. Sometimes they fall down but cry and everything, and they'd be really beat up by the time they make it to the end. And those boys that we call them the brown nosers would stand up on a bed, and whoever don't hit hard would be stripped down and then run down the gauntlet. And even though I don't want to, even my friends were, Luke Titus was one of them, my friend from Minto. He's a Reverend Luke Titus now. He was one of them that ran down the thing, and I hit him at heart. And he did the same to me. About 60-some years later, we met in old Minto recovery camp. That's why I could talk about it. We apologized to each other for hitting each other. We didn't have any choice. And he apologized to me first, and then I turned around and apologized to him for what happened, that hitting him with a belt. That was a really hard punishment. There was sexual abuse there, spiritual abuse, physical abuse. The physical abuse is just what I'm talking about. And spiritual abuse. In the classroom, I remember they had a big Bible, and this big woman,
she'd sit there and read us a Bible in the morning. And we were scared of her. So she'd scream at us and everything and lift that big Bible and pound it on the table and scared the hell out of us, you know. And that was, we had to go to a different church. We didn't, on Sunday, there was there was Catholic, all different kind of denomination. And we kind of enjoyed, I kind of enjoyed the Catholic church then because they took us into town during Christmas time.
Fred, thank you for starting it off with that experience. I feel like we need 2 hours to have this discussion or it needs to be continued for a long time. I want to go to the phones for just a moment, and then we'll get back to the conversation with our guests. Shelley is in Anchorage. Hi, Shelley. Did you have a question?
Oh, yeah. While I was listening to Fred, I was thinking, seems like that's the way the white people got rid of their worst people. They let them work at these boarding schools or orphanages and probably thought good riddance. But originally I wanted anybody to tell me what would have happened to the parents if the parents didn't let go of their kids or what would have been done to the parents?
If they wouldn't have had tried to resist their children being taken to boarding schools, is what I'm assuming you're asking.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul, is that a question that do you have some knowledge of? Were they charged with some sort of legal?
It depends on the period in history. Initially, when the first taking were occurring, which by that I mean the first, say, generation of 20 or years or so, beginning in the post-Civil War, what they would do is they would cut the rations off for the entire tribe that were on the reservations. So they just wouldn't be fed until they gave up the children. And so the family members in the tribe faced the prospect of these children starving to death with them or being taken away. And so that was one of the options that was given. In other cases, they were tied, chained in public, the families that resisted. And those were just two examples. I'd rather not go into all the other ways in which they would coerce the tribes and families into forcibly allowing their children to be taken from them.
So they really had no choice. There wasn't any sort of decision making. It was a forced situation.
Absolutely. This is an offer that you can't refuse. The federal government in this capacity is essentially what we would today call an ongoing criminal organization in their conduct towards the tribes in the forcible taking of tribal members and children.
We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take more phone calls, more questions about the legacy of Native boarding schools as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Reading colors your world. This summer, help the children in your life develop lifelong habits and a love of reading by signing up for your local library's summer reading program. They'll stay engaged with literacy and learning activities, track their progress all summer long, and can even earn prizes. Visit your local library's website for more information. This message sponsored by the Alaska Library Network.
welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the legacy of Native boarding schools today with Fred John Jr., who attended the Wrangell Institute and other boarding schools in the Lower 48, Jim LaBelle, who attended Wrangell and Mount Edgecombe and serves on the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, and Paul Unktaguk, who recently retired as the Director of Alaska Native Studies for the University of Alaska Anchorage. Let's go to the phones again. And we are going to hear from Nelson in Anchorage. Hi, Nelson.
Good morning, Jim and Fred and all of you. I thank you for the opportunity to ask a question. Some of us survived the boarding school. And the questions that the one question that has lingered in my mind is that after I became familiar with the fact that many of our warriors who were in Vietnam and other battlefields came back with PTSD, and I've often wondered if the children who attended the boarding school, the American Indians, Alaska Natives, and others that were forced to attend boarding schools, have experienced PTSD, and what would trigger those. I was a mature 14-year-old student at Wrangell Institute, could hardly speak English, and I got punished severely for speaking Yupik, the only language I could really speak. So thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, Nelson, and for sharing your experience. I know this isn't easy for people to talk about. And the question about PTSD is an interesting one, and one that I've wondered about too. Paul, as we know more about post-traumatic stress disorder and generational trauma, how do you see this manifesting itself in people who are descendants of those who attended boarding schools?
Well, I think it's evident in all the wrong statistics that are so prevalent in many Alaska Native communities. The simple way to understand it is we could not have been here for thousands of years and for multiple generations without cultures that were effective and that were positive and that were organized and useful as
and
a way to live and healthy. So when did these unhealthy statistics start to become such a part of our communities? And that would have been with contact, with colonization, and the kind of conduct, the way that we were, as communities and tribes, were taken into sort of the American agenda. And it's not us volunteering and wanting an adventure as immigrants coming to a new land. It's the government landing on us as tribes. And the goal is sort of manifest larceny. It's how do we take native lands in the most effective way? And so all of these traumas are piled on top of each other, and you're not able to even express it or talk about it because it's so painful. And that's certainly the remarkable thing is people like Jim and Fred and Nelson and others who've gone through these experiences that have survived, one, physically, are here with us, and two, that have had enough healing so that they're able to share their experience and help other people to face it and begin to process it in a more positive way. So they really are excuse me.
add, there were very specific things that that would bring me back to become a little 8-year-old in Durango. The certain kinds of noises, keys rattling, looking in the face of a matron who is had a stare and had a tone of voice that was eminent to punishment. Certain kinds of smells. We had to clean our dorms with very toxic chemicals on the floor and on the bathrooms. And whenever I have that chance of smelling those again, it just kind of brings me back to those times or hearing certain noises.
I know that when Jim was talking earlier about lye soap, I interviewed an elder on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota many years ago who told me she had nearly no taste buds left because when she was at a boarding school, teachers would put lye soap on her tongue when she spoke her native language. But a friend here in Alaska said her boarding school experience was fine. It was in elementary school in Shungnak that she was punished for speaking her language. She said she was forced to stand in a small circle for hours and that her legs and hips would ache terribly when she went home so she could hardly walk. And she said she still has trouble with her hips today and wonders if it goes back to that time when she was a small child and forced to stand. So it wasn't just boarding schools where harsh treatment was meted out to Native children. Paul, is there much known about the distinctions here between the treatment of Native kids who were sent away to school and those who had their culture denounced and oppressed in their very own communities?
Well, there was that, and then there was a third element, which is all the kids who were institutionalized or pushed through the foster care system, which was terribly uneven in its experience. I went through the foster care system and in a time that for us, it was a particularly brutal experience. I actually ran away from a foster home and spent the homeless population in Seattle considered me to be a homeless tourist, as anybody who was new to on the street they called tourist, and they a part of them sort of took you in and warned you about the risk and hazards and who to avoid and where to go and how to sort of make
survive.
Your way through.
Yeah.
And so it's the boarding school, the experiences of some of the way schools were operated, and then the foster care institutionalization, the Indian homes, Native American homes, that people were placed in. It's all a mix.
Well, and I read in the report how the boarding home concept where young people could come from villages, go into urban areas to attend high school and were placed in homes that sometimes were quite abusive, that these families were paid to house the children and there was abuse, and that would lead to this sort of downward spiral for some young people who would end up running away and then get caught in that foster care system. And just, you know, it was like a self-perpetuating bad experience that just continued on. The same Alaska Native elder told me that the boarding schools she attended both in Alaska and outside were actually good educational experiences that helped her succeed in higher education. And are there similar stories that you've heard that some of the schools, despite the hardship of children being away from their families, were an experience that helped them prepare for life and work in an increasingly encroaching white society where it almost, there was no going back to isolating communities so that you would have to sort of know how to live in both worlds?
Certainly, there were many, many people, and particularly in the more recent era, who had very positive and continue to have very positive boarding school experiences. The current Mount Edgecombe boarding school is selective, and at the same time, it's become, from what I understand, a very positive experience. The private religious boarding schools, Covenant High School, when it was operated by the Covenant Church, some of the Catholic boarding schools and others had very positive outcomes for many of the students. One of the things that I think is important is many of the people that I've talked with, including former colleagues at the university, would say things like, well, it was a positive experience for me. You know, I lost contact with native language and cultures, but, you know, I'm trying to recover that. I'm just glad that I had the kind of education that got me here. And my position on that is, but you were forced to make a false choice, which was preparation to be successful in broader society at the cost of connecting to family, language, and tribes. That was not a necessary bargain. In fact, it was a terrible bargain. And it wasn't a choice on your part. It was just something that you learned to cope with as the price mm-hmm. of this. And what they also don't think about is for all the people that bargain was rejected. And I knew a lot of very intelligent, highly capable people who would not take that bargain. They rejected the education as a way of rejecting the cultural assimilation. And that has also some very consequential outcomes for not only those individuals, but for the tribes that they were a part of as well.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment, and then we'll get back to Fred and Jim as we continue our conversation here. Ruthie is at Fish Camp in Bethel. Hi, Ruthie.
Hi, I'm so glad to hear you guys talk about familiar things. Those at that time when I was going to boarding school in Wrangell Institute in 1967, I was 15 years old. Molly Hoot's case had started then, and villagers were sent to places where there was high school. So my parents let me go to Wrangell Institute. It was a very positive experience for us at that time. There were little kids from 5 years old to all the way to 15 years old. I was one of the older ones with the rest of the people that went. And I heard a lot of languages there, Inupiaq language, Yupik language, Athabascan language. At one time in the bathroom, I heard all the different languages. No one did anything to us. Even we spoke our language. I had very positive experience. The matrons were so nice. The night shift person was very, very nice to us. And our clothes, I still remember my clothes number. They would wash clothes and put them in our, my number is 107. I still never forgot it to this day. And we were taught how to be better people. Like we would, they would let us go to church, to which choice of church they would bring us to. We were churchgoers at my village, and it still continued when I was there in Wrangell. And so mine was very positive. I learned a lot of things. I learned how to be responsible. And that was the first year I had no Christmas with my parents. There were no phones in the villages. There was only one phone in the village. They couldn't contact us. We couldn't contact them. When I had a letter and they sent me a picture and a few couple dollars, like $15, I really cried looking at their pictures because I knew I wasn't going to be there for Christmas, first time as a 15-year-old anyway. And also I was also went to Bethel, stayed with my aunt. She was getting paid I experienced that. And since she's my auntie, she took care of me so well. Mm. I would run home, eat lunch really fast for 10 minutes because I wanted to be in course. Because she lived not too far from where my high school was, Bethel High School.
Well, Ruthie, thank
so
you.
Mine was very positive. So
thank you.
I'm glad to hear about other people that are, went through a bad thing.
Yes, and I appreciate your call and your perspective, and particularly about Wrangell, because a lot of the stories of abuse highlight Wrangell as one of the worst places for people being abused. I know that both Fred and Jim attended the Wrangell Institute, and we want to get back to them. We do need to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation on the legacy of Native boarding schools as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Alaska USA has been on a journey with Alaskans since their first member account was opened in 1948. They'll be with you every step of the way, through the challenges of today and the hopes of tomorrow. AlaskaUSA.org. This message sponsored by Alaska USA.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Jim or Fred, I want to get you back in here. Are you or have you had discussions with your grandchildren, your younger generations about the boarding schools? How do you talk to them about that experience? Jim, you want
to... I got four girls and a son, and I didn't really talk to them for years. I never talk about my boarding school experience probably for about 50 years. I kept a wall around me, an imaginary wall, so I wouldn't ever got hurt again. So I never talk about it. I became an alcoholic. I kept my family. My family kept me together then. I don't think I kept them. And when I came back from recovery camp, I told my story there the first time, my whole life story, and it took about 3 weeks before I started feeling little freedom for telling my story. And my kids hear about my story, and they know my experience and everything. And my daughter wrote about the boarding school at Wrangell Institute, and I was called number 77. And I appreciate she wrote just what I went through in everything. It's about 5 minutes read. I don't think I have time to read it here.
Right.
But the experience, people ask me, what do you tell your children? I tell them, forgive us. Forgive us for not learning how to make sled. Forgive us for not making snowshoes and boats and canoe and all those things that our uncle and our aunties taught us, the woman and sewing and everything. It was this and a 50. We weren't home, so we never learned those things that our culture teach us, how to be a human being, fish wheel, giving and receiving, you know, all those gifts our Creator gave us as Native people. And I had to relearn. I had to relearn that. I live the Native way now, and I'm free. And I talk. I've been talking about boarding school. You can cut me off anytime because I talk too much. But I wrote everything I know. I remembered about boarding school. It all came back to me as I read it. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And I wrote it, and I put it out on Facebook for everybody to read, everybody to, get a hold of it and understand what happened in my generation, our generation that were back in the 50s and the 40s. Because we went through them years. It was those terrible years that I don't think the student in Wrangell went through the 60s and the 70s. I had others that followed us in the 60s and 70s, and they never, you know, they haven't been hurt like we were, and yes. then abused and go into our own self-made prison.
I'm glad that you've been able to heal yourself and reconnect to the strength of your culture. That's so important. And I wanted to get to an email question. We only have a few minutes left, and I think that we're going to need to put another program together and revisit this issue and look forward at what education should look like in the future. And so we'll work on putting that together. But a question from Diane by email today asks, has the federal government ever issued an apology? Have any survivors ever sued for reparations? Or are there any groups working on mounting pressure for reparations? Do any of you have any insight into whether or not the federal government has addressed this whatsoever?
Paul, the short answer is no, nothing that I'm aware of. There have been individual communities that have apologized for their role. Some of the churches have apologized for the role that their boarding schools have played in this, but it's been very uneven. And there's certainly nothing on the federal or state level that represents a formal apology or compensation.
Let's go back to the phones quickly. Hannah is in Sitka. Hi, Hannah.
Hi. Thank you so much for this. This is so important as an ally and non-Native. The idea that storytelling can really heal is important. As a community member, in Sitka, we still have the Sheldon Jackson campus, which has been amazingly converted to an arts campus, which is an opportunity for real healing. However, there's a large group of people that can't still go on campus because they feel like their stories haven't been acknowledged or there's too much pain. My biggest question, and what I'd love to get advice on, is how do you, in a place like Sitka, create space for healing? How do you make safe space for people to tell their stories? I'd love to hear, get some advice about that.
Well, that's a big question, and we are running low on time. I think that, you know, it just takes people being in conversation and coming together and being clear in their intention of wanting to support and hear without judgment and allow that space for people to talk openly. In our last couple of minutes here, Paul, we know of the Molly Hooch decision in the 70s that said the state had to provide high schools in Native villages so that young people could stay in their communities. At first it was 8 students, then it went to 10. You're critical of state management of rural schools. Do you think it would be better to have federal oversight?
Well, the short version is that I think the Molly Hooch case for the small village high schools, so that Native kids could have the same experience, Alaska Native kids could have the same experience as white Alaskan kids, which is to have a locally available high school education. That was only fair to try to do that. How well it was implemented is always a huge issue. I think one of the worst aspects of it was that the price that was unfortunately made was to lose sight of the federal trust responsibility for the education of Native Americans who are in Alaska. It's tribal federal relationship concerning education. And that's an enormous topic to consider going forward because it has huge implications.
Mm-hmm. And a question out to Jim and Fred just in our last couple of minutes here. There is a question by Jim's daughter that she wrote in and asked, first thanking all of you for being brave and discussing such a painful topic. But she says her question is, how do we make this history lesson more accessible to a wider audience? So what ideas do you have for how we can make sure that these lessons are understood so that they aren't repeated in the future, which we know is so important for so many things that we've have a historical context on. Fred, would you like to address that?
I really don't know. I don't think I would know, but what I, for myself, what I've been doing, and it just, and while I'm alive and everything, school, little grade school, hear about the stories I write and everything, and they invite me. There's about five little grade school in Fairbanks that invited me, took me. Sometimes they took me for 5 hours straight, and I tell them about boarding school. And the kids, you know, they never heard about it before. And, of course, you know, they won't cry or anything, but you should hear the, you should hear some of the parents if they're there, and the staff and the workers and the principal sometimes. They broke down, and they never heard stories like that. They never, and I tell it in a good way where I don't try to, you know, attack anybody or anything, but I tell what happened. The truth, you know, and what really happened there without attacking, without, and telling them that nobody really knew what happened behind closed door, you know, closed right. BIA door.
Yes.
So, and that's how I do it.
I'm glad that you're doing that, taking that message into schools to help educate. Jim, are there efforts that you're undertaking in along that same, those same lines?
Well, I'd like to,
we've got about 30 seconds or so.
What Fred is doing is just wonderful, but I'd take it up a notch and make the history of Alaska Native people a part of all of the curriculum in Alaska, beginning in grade school and high school. That's where I would start.
Yeah, the full history needs to be told. And Paul, in a couple of just about 30 seconds, what are your thoughts?
Again, I just can't say how much I appreciate Jim and Fred for what they've done. It's an enormous contribution to our communities and tribes and the state of Alaska.
It absolutely is, and thank you for that, because it's true that it's a difficult thing to discuss painful events from your past, and sharing those difficult experiences is important. So thank you, Fred John Jr., Jim LaBelle, and Paul Unktaguk for being on with me today. Thanks to Adeline Baxter, our producer, and Tobin Shelby, our engineer. We'll be back next week. Thanks so much for listening today. And remember that there's resources on our website if you're feeling stressed or having anxiety over today's discussion. Go to alaskapublic.org, and the Talk of Alaska Post has some resources available there. Thanks for listening today.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.